G-Force, a kaiju podcast.
G-Force?
Well, it's big and terrible. More frightening than I ever thought possible.
Kiss you, guys.
What terrible language!
Calling Monster Island. Calling Monster Island.
And now, your hosts.
One is me, and the other is Godzilla.
Nick and Andrew.
Hello and welcome to episode 71 of G-Force, a kaiju podcast, a show in which a rotating cast of kaiju enthusiasts gets together every other week to discuss all things kaiju. My name is Nick, and with me is my co-host.
Hi, this is Andrew.
And with us today we have...
Hey, this is James.
Hey, this is Ike.
And today we will be discussing 1972's Godzilla vs. Gigan, and I hope it bugs you as much as it bugs me that this is episode 71 discussing a movie from 72.
Oh, no! Speaking of weird things about the numbering, how strange is it that we are talking about this movie that is over 50 years old now?
Yeah, I remember when Godzilla himself was 50 years old. I was only 5. I actually don't think I knew Godzilla was 50 years old at the time, but I remember being 5 in 2004.
Time is weird.
Yeah. Godzilla vs. Gigan was directed by Jun Fukuda when we're actually recording on Jun Fukuda's 101st birthday today, February 17th, and it was written by the man himself, Shinichi Sekizawa.
Down on his luck, manga artist Gengo applies for a job at World Children's Land, a giant monster-themed amusement park whose main tower is a life-size Godzilla sculpture, and whose aim is to educate children about world peace. Absolute peace. However, on his way into the interview, he runs into the fleeing Machiko, who drops a stolen data tape that Gengo takes possession of. After securing a job from the creepy, surprisingly young CEO of World Children's Land, Gengo runs into Machiko and her hippie friend Shosaku, who suspect Children's Land of being a front for something sinister, and believe that they're holding Machiko's vanished brother Takeshi, a computer programmer, captive. When the group play the mystery tape, the resultant recording means nothing to them. But on faraway Monster Island, the strange sounds rouse Godzilla, who sends Anguirus to the mainland to investigate. It's clear that he's gotten somewhat lazy since becoming a parent, but honestly, I send my kids to go take care of things the same way. I just don't want to get off the couch. Investigating Children's Land, Gengo discovers that the CEO and his right-hand man are identical in appearance to a young student and his teacher who died in a mountain climbing accident. Meanwhile, Anguirus is driven off by the military, but is troubled enough by what he sees to summon Godzilla to Japan. Children's Land thugs nearly capture Gengo, Machiko, and Shosaku, but Gengo's black belt girlfriend, Tomoko, drives them off. The thugs do recover the tape, however, and with its signal, summon Gigan and King Ghidorah. The men behind Children's Land are revealed to be cockroach-like aliens from the Hunter M Nebula, using human corpses as disguises, and are seeking to trade in their overpolluted planet for Earth. Once they have conquered it for themselves, and end the reign of humanity that is polluting the planet much as their own had been, the children of Earth will know the perfect world peace of oblivion. Infiltrating and escaping Godzilla Tower with the captured Takeshi, the intrepid posse of protagonists go to the military, who make a plan to assault the tower even as Godzilla and Anguirus join battle with a post-rampage Gigan and Ghidorah. The flying, buzzsaw-wielding Gigan has Godzilla on the ropes, and even more so, Godzilla Tower itself, which is revealed to have a built-in death ray. However, when the human heroes manage to blow up the tower with the aid of some life-sized manga, killing the Hunter M Nebulans and disrupting their control signal, Godzilla manages to turn the tables on his opponents, and with Anguirus' help sends the space monsters fleeing back into the cosmos, and returns to Monster Island a hero. And, you know, I guess Anguirus is a hero too, but no one sings a song about him at the end.
So, sometime at the end of our previous season, Andrew and I realized that most of our opening thoughts segments are basically just the final thoughts at the start of the episode. So we decided to change that going forward. So, guys, what's your history with Godzilla vs. Gigan?
For me, this is one that I got as VHS at a library surplus sale. It was that black cover that had, like, orange flames and a Gigan that looks like a colorized black and white photo. This is one that I watched a lot, and it was one of my favorites growing up because Gigan was one of my favorites. I tend to have more of a weird relationship with it these days because I love the movie conceptually, but in my head it just occupies this completely vanilla space. Like, to me, there's something bland about it, more so than any of the other entries. I just kind of never really choose to rewatch it. And I don't know why that is, because, yeah, the color palette's a bit drab, the fashions and styles and filmmaking is all the height of sort of formulaic 70s mundanity, but the story's fun and inventive. It's got crazy concepts and a great monster. I know I enjoy this one, and I always do when I watch it. I especially like, you know, the human characters, but I just have a hard time remembering that typically in between views. I just sort of think of it as, oh, that slow one. So that's sort of where I came into this one with. And ironically, I watched it about 3 weeks ago, my boy seeing it the first time, and I just really, once again, did not want to rewatch it for this podcast. I just felt like, I don't know, I'm just kind of bored going back through that. But about 3 hours ago, I sat down and rewatched it anyway. So we'll see how my impressions came across this time.
My history with this movie is pretty similar to my history with like all of the 70s kind of later Showa movies, which is like, you know, as a little kid, when I was like still hunting down Godzilla movies, this is one that like I liked because I liked every Godzilla movie. And then, you know, get a little older, you become like a teenager and you start to think, oh, the cheesy like later Showa movies are like not great. And Godzilla vs. Gigan's one of those. And then you get older again and you attain true maturity and you realize that the sillier movies are pretty great in their own way. So, yeah, I like this movie. I don't think I ever really super disliked it, but I think I've come to appreciate it a lot more. It's not like a perfect movie. There's plenty wrong with it. But yeah, I'm excited to get into it. And it was fun to revisit it recently. It's not kind of like Andrew. It's not one I watch super often. But yeah.
For me, growing up, whenever I was exposed to this film, I was a very impressionable kid, like most people. So when I saw Godzilla in a tag team match against two alien kaiju with his dinosaur buddy Anguirus, I was pretty impressed back then. And kind of like James said, I went through the phase where I kind of quote unquote grew out of this film, you know, when you try to only like the serious film, so to speak. But years ago, I just fell back in love with this film, and it has a hefty spot in my top 10, and I don't think it's going to go anywhere, because I just really adore it. And I always have fond memories growing up and having that 50th anniversary DVD of this film. If you know the one I'm talking about with Godzilla on a cover, he's kind of like has his arms up in a sort of a Rocky pose. And you got Gigan on the cover, I think, and King Ghidorah flying in the background, like green lightning everywhere or something. But I got a lot of fond memories with this film. I'm happy that I still enjoy it to this day as I did when I was like four.
So this is one that I didn't really see for a long time as a kid because I didn't have, you know, a VHS tape of it, and the place I would go to rent VHS tapes didn't have it or anything. So, you know, it was one that was kind of mysterious to me for a while. But I had a Bandai figure of Gigan that I still have. So I always thought Gigan was really cool and I liked him in Godzilla Save the Earth and everything. And then one day, Sci-Fi Channel, back when it was still called the Sci-Fi Channel, was playing several Godzilla movies. And many of them I was seeing for the first time, including Godzilla versus Megalon, Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, GMK, and the film we're talking about today, Godzilla versus Gigan. And out of all of the movies, this was the one that kind of made the smallest impression on me. Something about it felt weird to me. I don't really know how to put it into words, but for whatever reason, I got like a weird feeling watching the movie. I think just like the monster scenes were so like the lighting was so dark and drab to me. So for whatever reason, just gave me an odd feeling and I just never felt the need to go back to it. And then eventually I did get the DVD of it when I was maybe like 12-ish. And again, I watched it. Didn't necessarily give me a weird feeling this time, but again, it didn't stick with me. I never really felt the desire to rewatch it. And in recent years, rewatching it, it just still doesn't really stick with me so far. I'm just whatever reason, every time I've watched it so far, it's just not really my thing. There are things I like about it, but there are also things I'm not super into. And this time, well, you know, we'll discuss that. So let's move on to the story and characters.
That's my brother's. Look, T.S., that's his initials.
What's his name?
Takeshishima.
And where did you find this?
In the tower.
Oh, did you see him?
Didn't see anyone. But I'm sure he's there.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy to find him.
The whole thing gets more suspicious every minute. Perfect peace, my eye.
For our cast, we have Hiroshi Ishikawa as Gengo Odaka, Tomoko Umeda as Machiko Shima, Yuriko Hishimi as Tomoko Tomoe, Minoru Takashima as Shosaku Takasugi, Zan Fujita as Fumio Sudo, Toshiaki Nishizawa as Kubota, Kunio Murai as Takeshi Shima, and Gen Shimizu as Self-Defense Force Commander. I felt like he was on screen long enough to warrant being listed with the rest of the cast.
I did notice that it is a very closed cast. I do think that an artifact of the decreased budget for this one, there are almost no extras. We have four main characters, a minor character, you know, her brother, two bad guys, and like there are a couple of thugs for the bad guys, and one guy with the army general. But that's about it in the whole movie. It is an extremely limited cast of characters, and the entire rest of the world almost, it seems like other people don't exist, except for that one scene where they go to the hometown and meet the mother and priest, I guess. But what I'm saying is, it kind of makes sense that you would include someone like him in the cast list, because it is a very small cast, and everything in the movie is done by that cast. And no one else. You know what I mean? It just feels like there's a handful of players and spectacularly, obviously, nobody else. So it kind of makes sense to count whoever you got.
And it somehow gets even worse in the next movie.
Yeah, that's true. But at least they're out in the countryside, so it makes sense that we never see anyone. But I'll get to that in the monster section.
So I will say one of the things I mentioned before that I am really into with this movie is the human characters. I don't think, you know, the story here is necessarily super special, but I just find all of them to have, or most of them at least, to have a lot of personality. And I think they're very fun to watch, especially Gengo, and the hippie, the corncob hippie. I think they're both hilarious.
I really like the cast in this film. You know, you got the karate girlfriend and the corn hippie, and then the aliens with the awesome jumpsuits on. But I really appreciate this cast because for me, as long as they're memorable and entertaining to watch, even if the overall story is kind of so-so, then that's a plus for me. But especially when watching like other tokusatsu, like, you know, shows or even Gamera at the time, the same time this film came out, they kind of fit. You know what I mean? They got the 70s clothes and they're at least entertaining. And for me, that's just what's really important. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree. And Shinichi Sekizawa, and at this point, I believe he was pretty open about he was running out of ideas. But even still, he knew how to write some entertaining characters. And I appreciate him. I appreciate him for a lot of reasons, but I appreciate him for that, definitely.
It definitely does feel like a Sekizawa script. Like, you have that just kind of close-knit group of slightly quirky, kind of lighthearted characters. It feels like maybe the most straight comedic script since King Kong vs. Godzilla. Maybe since Abira, but like there's like a lot of just like gags in this movie. For example, corncob hippie. There's the, you know, infamous moment where he sticks the corncob in the guy's back and then he opens the corncob. And then the very next scene, the corncob is like half eaten. So he's like been eating the corncob like between shots, which like, I don't know, I just found hilarious. Also, the guy, whoever plays the main guy, there's something very kind of broadly comedic about his performance. Like, he does all these I wonder if he was like a known like comedian in Japan, like if he was a bit of a stunt casting, because he does all these kind of funny like mugs at the camera where he's like not quite breaking the fourth wall, but he's just kind of like over kind of reacting to certain things in like a kind of very broadly comedic way, which is interesting. I guess that both of those things are more to direction than to script, but it does seem like a kind of a comedic movie. Not always effective. Like, it's not Sekizawa's best script, in my opinion, or even like one of the best, but it definitely feels like Sekizawa.
Yeah, I really enjoy that comedic performance. And I noted especially the slapstick bit while he's waiting to see the CEO and is sort of messing around, seeing if the camera is following him. And then he leans against the globe and, you know, the whole thing crashes over. I ended up enjoying him and a lot of his sort of more comedic double takes and reactions to things a lot more this time around. Just he has a fun comic charisma.
One of the moments with him I love is, I can't remember where he was. He might have been in the Children's Land, like, you know, office thing or whatever, but he answers the phone. But for whatever reason, he does like a really high-pitched voice when he does it. And I thought that was pretty funny.
Moshi moshi?
I also love at one point whenever, you know, like the main core characters are like talking about what they're like going to do next and everything. And once they figure it out and they decide to leave, they're all eating bananas in this scene for some reason. And then when they leave, Gango just tosses his banana just up in the air as they're leaving for seemingly no reason. And it's really great.
A lot of food humor in this movie.
Another gag I like is when Gango's in his apartment drawing one of his illustrations in the manga. And Tomoko comes over and the scene ends of her kind of just looking at the picture, and it's the monster has her t-shirt as part of its design. It's like the homework monster, I believe. And I always found that bit pretty funny.
It was the strict mother's monster.
Strict mother. Oh, okay.
And that's one of the great things, because when she's like, he's like, oh, I just want to take a rest from job searching. She's like, no, we got to keep moving. He infamously calls her a hard female dog in the dub. But in the original, he's just saying, oh, you mamagon, which is the name he's given that strict monster mother. And so that's how we see him drawing it later. It's like you get the idea he got the inspiration from that scene where she's pushing him to go get a job. So it's a really great little bit that is obscured in the English dub.
In the dub, when they have the guy say hard female dog, do you think when they're translating that movie, like, do you think they really thought that's what he said? Like he said the Japanese equivalent of like bitch? Or do you think it's like a similar energy to that one like factory worker who recorded swears in a Tickle Me Elmo? Like,
I really think it sounded like he actually said the word mamagon. So either they didn't know what that was and were just like, put whatever you want, or nobody's going to get that. Just make up whatever you want. Something that he would look sheepish about afterwards.
My theory is that he calls her a mamagon, like Andrew was saying, like before we find out what mamagon even is. And I think they might have just thought it didn't make any sense that way. So they just had him say something else and for some reason made it really vulgar.
Which is a shame, because like I said, I think it's a good gag and it treats the audience as not stupid in the Japanese version. It's like, you don't know what that means? Well, you'll find out in two scenes. So just hold that in your head. You're a grown up. You could do that, right? Even if you're a kid, you could probably do that. It's not that long.
Yeah.
But speaking of the of Gango, I do really love, probably my favorite set in the movie is his art-strewn apartment. It's very 70s. It's really rad. I love all the red in it. There's that weird little sort of decorative corner of bricks up above the couch. Like, just all these neat little design touches. So I love his pad. And I also have to say, he's got no excuse for shopping around half-finished artwork at the beginning. The guy's right to complain, because based on the way that, you know, they defeat the aliens at the end, he is a super speed artist. Like, he can crank a life-size, fully detailed drawing out in a matter of minutes. So it's clearly just procrastination that he hasn't put the homework monster in there yet.
It's also kind of amazing that Nebulans fall for that.
Well, yes. But, I mean, hey, he must be great at hitting deadlines.
Yeah.
I figure he's taking a chance on adrenaline. Like, the moment they see a human figure, bang, don't stop to think about what it is. Just
he's perfect for a weekly Shonen Jump. Crank those out in a week, no problem.
Yeah, there you go.
Listen, here's the thing about the Nebulans, is they're pretty bad. Like, they're pretty, like, incompetent at world conquering. Like, not quite as bad as the Garoga, but like, for example, if you're hiring someone and you're trying to keep everything low key, like you're just, you know, you're hiring someone for your front. You don't want him to be part of your evil plan. He's just there for your front. Don't start pontificating about bringing peace to the world and making vague hints about destroying Monsterland and like forcing people into peace and stuff.
It wasn't even a vague hint. He literally just goes, "We will destroy Monster Island."
Yeah, I know. It's so bad.
And there is no concern about the fact that they have the ability to do that. No one asks how. And no one's like, "It concerns me that you, an amusement park company, believe that you have the ability to accomplish this."
Right. That's like if I went to like get a job at Kennywood, which is like Pittsburgh's big amusement park, and they were like, "Yeah, man, we're going to just destroy San Francisco after this." Like, after this season, we're destroying that whole city, man. And just everyone's like, "All right."
We've talked before about the whole idea of having a theme park based on kaiju and what that would be. You almost have to think of the 70s movies as existing in their own universe separate from the 50s, 60s movies. But like the fact that in how many of those movies were they looking for a way to destroy Godzilla? And here this guy who's currently building Ferris wheels is like, "Oh yeah, no, I can do that, no problem. As soon as we're done building this park."
Yeah, honestly, next time I go for a job interview and they're going to ask me, "What are your long-term goals with our company?" I'm going to say, "I'm going to destroy this damn company."
Counterpoint, though, that it is true that their operational security is poor. On the other hand, would you question anything that you heard from somebody sitting in as rad a chair as that CEO has?
It is a rad chair.
It's like a replica of half the moon.
Solid point.
But turned into one of those egg chairs from the beginning of Men in Black. That is the coolest chair I've ever seen.
It's very Bond villain.
It is very Bond villain. I mean, to be fair, so is his outfit, so is his giant tower, so is pretty much everything about him.
Yeah.
One thing I really found interesting this time, it was a little line, just a little throwaway line, when they've figured out and they've given him the homing cigarettes, which I love how of its time this movie is, that just everyone smokes, is assumed to. But they talk about how he's like crafty, but also stupid. And he's a rare specimen for our collection. And I love the implication that even though they're using most of them for like bodies and things, they maybe plan to collect humans the way that some humans collect bugs. I just thought that was kind of a nice touch, you know?
That's a good catch, man.
As far as I can tell, their original plan seems to be that they would just build this whole theme park. And I don't know why they felt like they needed to have the whole theme park built before they could wipe out Monster Island. But as part of their cover story, get the whole thing built. That's why they hire people like Gengo, just to keep up appearances. When they finish it, then they will wipe out Monster Island. Then they will call in Gigan and Ghidorah because there will be no one left to oppose them. And so the whole theft of the tape just kind of accelerated their plans and caused the invasion to happen months or even years earlier. But I think that was their plan, as best I can figure it out. That somehow, once they completed their theme park, that would be sufficient justification for them to publicly destroy Monster Island. And that's what they were waiting for to then move on.
My question is, why did they need a front at all? Why did they need a theme park at all?
Right. It's got a certain dream logic to it, but it is like, why did you need to do that? Why not just blow up Monster Island immediately and then invade? But like I said, it's got this dream logic. We got to finish our theme park first so that everyone will accept that there are replacement monsters and now we can destroy the originals. And then we can kick off our plan.
You're right, because, you know, it could be this. The Nebulans, they're just giant cockroaches, right? And from my understanding, from my latest viewing of the film, they kind of took over their own planet after the original race that was in charge got wiped out due to pollution, if I remember correctly. So maybe the Nebulans just wanted to have a Ferris wheel to finally go on. Building a giant monster amusement park. There's no lion.
It was all about the Ferris wheel. And ironically, that's the first thing to get destroyed in the monster fight. That's the tragedy of this movie.
Right? It all makes sense now.
It does begin this franchise's hatred of Ferris wheels that, you know, continues on a fine tradition.
Yeah, Bachelor's got the same kind of mindset with Ferris wheels.
Maybe it's a bug thing.
If we had just built one in the middle of Monster Island instead of a top secret control center, there never would have been any problems in 1999.
While we're talking about the Nebulans, by the way, I'm gonna insert the There For You clip from the dub in honor of Evan.
Ah, cigarettes. There For You.
Oh, I was going to say, that's one of it. I was thinking of that, like, the whole time, just because of Evan. Just having that, waiting for that line to come up.
And this is definitely a case where I have so much affection for the dub. One of my absolute favorite moments in the dub is when Kubota throws Gengo the pack of cigarettes and says, "There For You."
It's funny that I do really like all of the cast in this movie. I think they're very charismatic. I think they're maybe my favorite full cast of a Showa Godzilla movie, or at least of the 70s. I mean, I think the trio of Ichinose, Katsura, and Mifune probably jumps up above that, but they've got a few forgettable people on their ensemble. When you judge the whole thing all together, I feel like this is one of my favorites. I just don't necessarily have that much to say about them. But I love how Machiko doesn't miss a beat. Like, she comes in, sees a gun, bam, right into karate action. Then she sees the potential employer and is like, oh no, which it just feels like such a very human thing to do. It's like, oh no, have I somehow read this wrong? Have I messed things up with my boss? Am I going to lose my job? Like, you had just saw guns, but you still managed to second guess yourself when you see your boss.
Yeah. I love that. That's one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
And they planned that earlier in the movie. Like, it doesn't come out of nowhere that she knows karate. They say that she's like a black belt or something, like in an early scene.
I would have loved to see like more of that, but what we get of it is really good.
You know, I find it interesting to kind of think about in regards to the Nebulans, how in one of like the early scripts of this film, it was supposed to be Godzilla fighting three monsters and a giant alien brain, from what I can remember. I think it was called like Godzilla, and then the alien was going to be called Meiji or something. But it's kind of funny to think about how he went from a giant brain alien controlling kaiju to cockroaches.
Yeah, that's interesting. It was Miko, because I have that right here. It was going to be Gigan accompanied by Megalon and King Ghidorah, which obviously did not happen. And as Miko prepared to destroy Japan, he sends the monsters to an international science exhibition to like stick his life support system, basically to stick his brain into the ancient Incan idol Meijin Tool being kept there. But as Gigan tries to cut into the statue, it comes alive to ward off the invaders with Godzilla and Anguirus joining him. So definitely Daimajin vibes with the whole, oh, so you start to cut into the statue and it bleeds, you know. But it's kind of funny that the original draft of this basically became Godzilla versus Gigan, Godzilla versus Megalon, and Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, because they clearly just took that idea and replaced it with King Caesar. So it's like he had this one script that basically got expanded out into the scripts of the next three movies instead of one, which is just kind of nuts to me. It's a lot like how 1994 seemed to inspire half the MonsterVerse. You know, it's just like you have this one golden unmade script that is an idea mine for, like, everything that comes after.
Dude, that's an incredible point, especially the whole MonsterVerse and Godzilla 94. But it's kind of funny to think about how Megalon was already, like, created, you know, that early, like, a year or so before his film even released.
I bet Sekizawa was happy that it played out that way, because, like I said before, he said he was running out of ideas by this point. So maybe it was intentional. He was like, man, maybe I should save some of these ideas for the future instead of just dumping the rest out all at once.
I love that idea of, yeah, like, I've got too many good ideas. Maybe let's hold a few of these back for the next time they ask me to write one.
Oh, gosh, I think he's fainted.
Huh? Huh, he must have thought it was a gun.
We didn't really talk about Corn Cob Hippie very much. But then again, I don't know what else to say other than it's really good whenever when Gengo thinks his corn is a gun.
Yeah, the main thing to say about Corn Cob Hippie is that he's a hippie with a corn cob.
Yeah.
And I do love our headcanon following Half Century War, that he is, you know, an adept of the Church of Mothra. It's a group of Mothra following hippies.
And that's just what he's, you know, it's just never mentioned in the movie. But that's probably what Mothra's up to since Destroy All Monsters, since she doesn't ever appear again anyway. She's just kind of leading the mainland into, she's having revivals. She's having spiritual tent meetings. She's just kind of converting the masses on the mainland.
Yeah, having like Burning Man festivals.
Yeah, she's got some televangelist stuff going on with the Shobijin. Send in your money now for the reclamation and replanting of Infant Island, and you too will be healed.
So Toho doesn't want us to know.
The Shobijin are like going around knocking on people's doors, except every time they have to go down here.
They knock on the doors, but no one hears them. So they just kind of wait for people to come out. Or, you know, they got a little grappling hook that they can throw up to get to the doorbell if possible. But yeah, the thing with the corncob hippie is it's the usual paradox that I know we've talked about before, which is, when something is bad, you have 1,000 things to say about it to analyze its every flaw. When something is good, it's hard to find something to say beyond it's good. And it's just like, yeah, I like all these characters. They're fun. I think they have a great interplay between each other. I would call that kind of the highlight of the film.
Yes.
But now I've said everything and I don't know what else to say about them, you know?
Especially the corncob hippie specifically, because it's not that it's the fact that it's good that there's just, you have less to say about it. It's also that the good thing about him is that he's funny. And then that's kind of it.
Right. It's all in the visuals of his performance.
He has a corn cob. He makes Gengo think the corn cob is a gun. And then he does a funny laugh, which is great. And then the only other thing I have to say about him is I like when they're talking to the parents of one of the dead guys that the Nebulans are using the image of. And the mom goes away to get pictures of him or something, I think. And they're saying something about him, I think discussing like whether or not he was smart.
Right. The CEO is smart. And oh, well, then it can't be this kid because he was kind of the class idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Gengo and the corn guy start laughing. And then as soon as the mom walks in, they just completely stop laughing and put on their serious faces. And it's so good. And that's everything I have to say about Corncob Hippie.
I guess for my part, to kind of just finish what I have to say about the human cast, the JSDF commander. This is like pretty much the last time we get to see the JSDF, like an actual face to them. You know what I'm saying? Instead of like stock footage in the next couple films or just Interpol. But what I like about the commander in this is that in one scene he's like, oh, our weapons can't do anything to the monsters. It's like another day for him. But when they're using like the sonar, they kind of hear King Ghidorah and Gigan. I like that he recognizes King Ghidorah, of course. But then he hears Gaiga and he's like, oh, a new one.
Yeah, I love the world building in that. That it's just like, this has become a standard part of military training. Know the roars of the monsters, because that's just part of the world. I love that sort of, you know, that's almost like a Godzilla 2000 kind of a world that's learned to live with the monsters idea.
I don't have too much more to say about the human characters. Like, there's not a lot to say about really any of them, for me at least. Like, they're just kind of light, fun characters. They're not as memorable as like previous Sekizawa like characters, but they get the job done, I guess.
Yeah.
So the only thing that I noticed about this, I felt like very similar to Godzilla versus Space Godzilla, the pacing and the story are really pretty good and the characters are really pretty interesting until the monsters show up. And that's where I feel like it gets bogged down, and even the things the humans are doing become slower, less productive things that take longer to get done. You know what I mean? It's just, it's sort of like the wall we talked about hitting in Godzilla 98, just after that sort of military muster scene where the movie really slows down. I feel like it's not as bad here. This doesn't have a Godzilla 98 level drop off, but I feel like it's very similar, that almost the scene where their shadows are revealed as cockroaches is the wall where everything after that just kind of flags a bit for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And I think it's because, like, it's kind of a criticism of the movie, but also not really, where it's like, we're in a phase of the Godzilla series where the movies are being more geared towards children, where, you know, budgets are being cut, but they still want to have lots of monsters on screen. Like, the purpose of the movie really is just to, like, set up getting to the monsters. And then after that, like, we don't really need a lot. We just kind of need to just do whatever to resolve the human story. Like this movie feels to me like Jun Fukuda tried to make an Ashiro Honda film, but he couldn't quite do it because he's Jun Fukuda. He should have just made a Jun Fukuda film.
I get what you mean.
Yeah, like it kind of has that Ashiro Honda blueprint, but it's just not as tight, you know? Like it's just like the characters are kind of like past Honda characters, but they're not quite as well realized. And the script is, it's Sekizawa again, but he's not like on his highest form. And then we kind of go through the motions and then we get to the monster stuff. And then it's just a big, fun monster movie, which is fine. Like, that's just kind of what this era of Godzilla is. And that's fine. And I've come to appreciate it. But like, I don't know, that's just what the movie is, you know?
And I think a part of that, and, you know, sort of transitioning into the monster section, I looked it up. A full 7 minutes of stock footage are in this less than 90-minute movie. It is about 8% of the entire film. And I mean, one thing, as an adult, the day for night tinted footage and the night shot footage really stand out and really clash. But, you know, it's not quite a tenth, but getting close to a tenth of the entire movie is stock footage. And honestly, most of the places it slows down is when they're throwing in a lot of that stock footage. Quite honestly, I think if they'd stuck to what they shot originally, the pace of the movie would have flowed a lot better, but we keep kind of stopping for these huge spectacle set pieces that are very clearly do not all fit together and don't come from this movie. And I mean, like Gamera Super Monster we talked about, yeah, they might have played fresher to an audience that didn't have access to the movies they came from on home video, so they wouldn't be as recognizable. But I think it's still obvious enough that they're jarringly mismatched from the footage shot for this movie, even if you don't recognize where they came from, that I just feel like, yeah, unfortunately, they tried to pad out the monster sequences to make it a bigger spectacle. And the film would have actually benefited if they'd just gone with what they'd been able to afford to do, because most of that stuff is pretty good.
And to be fair, also, some of the stock footage is from Destroy All Monsters, which came out, you know, 4 years before this, which, you know, that is probably a long time for the kids this was being marketed to. But then this movie, which was, you know, they were re-releasing older Godzilla movies during the Champion Festival.
Ooh.
One of which being Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, which features heavily in the stock footage in this movie. So I don't know if it had been re-released by the time this came out, but if it had, I'm sure there were at least some kids that were like, wait a second, I just saw that.
Hey, Future Nick here, having done the research that I should have done before we recorded this episode, but I just didn't think to do it. So yeah, 1971's Champion Festival included, on March 17th, Invasion of Astro Monster, July 24th, Godzilla vs. Ghidorah, and December 12th, Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster. And then next year's, the first Godzilla film they showed was, of course, Godzilla vs. Gigan on March 12th, just a few months after Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, and only a year after they showed Invasion of Astro Monster. So yeah, there were probably plenty of kids who were recognizing a lot of sequences from those two movies. There is also stock footage of Godzilla vs. Ghidorah in Godzilla vs. Gigan, but not quite as much, probably a lot easier to miss whenever you've only seen that movie once, and it was like almost a year ago. So yeah, the more you think about it, the more baffling the stock footage choices here continue to be.
Yeah, because I think all the stock footage criticisms are totally valid. You know, for me, I think the only one that's really egregious is Mothra having a cameo in this film. You know, she took a little break to stop talking about her new hippie clan, but you know, it's interesting because I feel like of all the movies, it's only this one and All Monsters Attack that are prone to having lots of stock footage. And even though All Monsters Attack, you know, with Honda's direction, does a good job kind of recontextualizing why there was stock footage in those scenes, when it comes to Gigan, it doesn't really hit as well. But with that being said, I like how when you look at when this film came out, right, before Gigan was Hedera, which had a bunch of new scenes, it's, you know, it's its own film. And then after Gigan, we get Megalon, which has four new monster costumes, which I'm sure was pretty expensive. You know, even Geigen in that film had a new suit. So I always find it interesting that for all the budget saving that Geigen had, it kind of, in a way, paid off with Megalon having so much new footage and new monster costumes.
But also a much smaller cast.
That too, yes. But that is a really good way of looking at it. Like, I had never thought about it like that.
I agree. Well, since we're, you know, talking about the stock footage now, let's move on to monsters and special effects. The special effects for this film were directed by Teruyoshi Nakano. Godzilla was played by Haruo Nakajima for the final time in the franchise. Anguirus was played by Koetsu Omiya. King Ghidorah was played by Kanta Ina. And Geigen was played by Kenpachiro Satsuma, who we sadly lost last year.
Talking about the stock footage and the pacing, I was particularly cognizant of this just after the arrival of Ghidorah and Geigen. I was noticing during all the city destruction scenes, you know, they probably could not afford the extras, but we don't see anyone in the street. We don't cut to a shot of a crowd running and screaming like we've always had. There's no one even reacting to it on a screen until we briefly get that with the Nebulans. But it really serves to isolate those scenes and make it feel like the space monsters are just attacking a model or somehow destroying an empty city. Like, there's literally no sign of humanity anywhere, just abandoned cars and views out of empty storefronts. And I liked the view out of the storefront shot with Geigen. It reminds me of, you know, a much cooler one of my favorite shots in Godzilla 2014 in the airport. But it makes it feel very lightweight and unreal, like it's happening somewhere abandoned and no one but the protagonists are even aware of it. Like, if it wasn't for the tank and jet attacks, you'd think that humanity hadn't even noticed that anything was happening. And it feels like a cutaway to those military guys that we saw recognizing the sound of the roar would help, or even a few voiceovers of people screaming or some radio chatter, you know, they're attacking the city and, you know, people are advised to evacuate, would have helped. Like, the whole night shooting and all the flames and everything is very striking, but the emptiness of the city offsets it and to me just makes it feel so much less real because there's just no connection to anything human.
Forgive me if you said this already, but were there any stock footage shots of, like, crowds running or anything that I'm just not remembering?
Nope. No human beings on screen for 7 minutes straight. I counted.
Wow, that's nuts. Adam Wingard is... he took some notes.
Don't the buildings at least, like, have, like, all their lights on?
A lot of them don't because they're day for night shots from Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster.
Oh, well, those, yeah.
They've been tinted blue and darkened, but there's no lights on. And again, we get a shot out of the storefront looking at Geigen's foot, and it looks like a deserted street, and it looks like no one's in the store. Like, there might be a few shots with lights on at the beginning, and again, there is a boat with lights on, like a cruise liner that is right offshore for some reason. There are tanks, and there are planes, which presumably have humans inside, but we get no radio chatter, not even a stock footage shot of, like, a guy in a cockpit of a plane, and we don't get any kind of, you know, again, any voiceovers, which would have cost nothing to indicate screaming people or whatever. And yeah, to your point, because so much of it is stock footage, most of the buildings don't even have their lights on because it's daytime scenes that are tinted blue.
And those day for night shots do look pretty bad.
They do. They look really bad. I think, honestly, that contributed to the weird feeling this movie gave me as a kid. The very, very dark new original footage, which does look cool, like, now as an adult. It looks very cool, especially with all the fire and everything. Very cool shots of Geigen roaring and stuff. But I think as a kid, the dark new footage and the day for night, which feels all kinds of off, stock footage, and then the emptiness of the city and just kind of the world in general in this movie, I think just contributed to how weird I felt the first time I watched this movie. Like, it just didn't feel quite right to me, and I think it was probably those things combined.
It's like having a kaiju attack during the pandemic. Nobody's outside.
Yeah.
And it's the middle of the night, so you can kind of excuse that, but only to a certain point. and they went past that point.
Right, like, where's the night college crowd swarming the streets and getting stomped on?
They're out smoking their corn cobs.
And I'm surprised they didn't think about using stock footage from War of the Gargantuans in the final fight. I'm pretty sure some nighttime crowd shots in Gargantuans. But, you know, they could use that if they didn't have the money for crowds, but they didn't.
It's weird because they do use the stock footage of them shooting the masers at, I think it was Gyra?
Yeah.
When he's like running behind the trees. And they do like a weird thing where they kind of have Gigan like get down like on his claws, like he's about to start crawling on all fours like behind the trees. It's really strange.
I think they do that again in Megalon.
Yeah, they do.
I think there is some new Maser Cannon footage though, like when Anguirus attacks. I think some of the Maser Cannon shots there is new.
And when King Ghidorah shoots back and blows up some of the Masers.
Yeah,
we actually get a new Maser model that I think is unique to this movie that they built to be blown up, you know?
Yeah, I think it's the Type 70 Maser that they had in this film. Then the stock footage is the Type 66.
I'm pretty sure this is the first appearance of the Maser Cannon, like, in a Godzilla movie. Like, obviously they were in Gargantuas, but I think this is the very first time they were in a Godzilla movie.
Is it really?
They weren't in Destroy All Monsters, were they?
No, but there was, like, a weird, not prototype, but, like, some kind of laser cannon artillery and Invasion Astro Monster, right?
There was the A-Cycle Light Ray, is that what it was called, which they used for the to unmind control the monsters.
Well, you're right. This is, I guess it's used so much in Heisei that I forget it's only in two Showa Godzilla movies, here and Megalon. You are right. This was the first Godzilla appearance. So there's, no matter what you think of the movie, celebrate this contribution to Godzilla canon.
No pun intended.
What would the series be without this?
Ike coming in with the knowledge on the different kinds of masers. I had no idea they were like different.
I can explain. I'm a nerd. But it was like last week I looked on Wikizilla. I was like, you know, there's some weird looking masers throughout the franchise. Like, what's that red one in Return of Godzilla? So I started reading about all the masers and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, Toho Kingdom actually has a good article and you know, some good imagery of the different kinds of, you know, the Type 66 Maser Beam Tank, which is the kind that we see here in the stock footage, and the second version that we get in the same movie. But I love me some Masers, so.
Oh, me too. I think Heisei might have my favorite Masers, though. Maybe.
Yeah, they do have some pretty excellent Masers there. Also, it's the Type 70 Maser Beam Tank is the new one we have here. You can tell that the stock footage ones from War of the Gargantuas, they lift up, but the barrel remains horizontal because the light bulb apparently would only function that way. Whereas the Type 70 ones that we see in this movie, and again as stock footage in Megalon, have a red sort of bubble turret, and the barrel can actually point and angle up at different angles. Again, Toho Kingdom has some great images of these as well. But probably, I guess, should talk a little more about the monsters and the Masers, even though we all know that Masers are the best. So yeah, as it is for that whole attack sequence, we have 7 solid minutes without any humans or Nebulans that look like humans on screen, just kaiju attacking with large amounts of stock footage. Then we get a shot of the villains watching on a screen, the one group that we'd already checked in with the start, the one group that does not show us anything of, you know, the human world being aware or dealing with these attacks, followed by 2 more minutes of heavy stock footage attacks in a totally different location, the Maser scenes we're just talking about. So yeah, this is where I was talking about the movie really feels like it starts to bog down. Even a few minutes later, when Godzilla and Anguirus arrives, it takes forever for the battle to actually start. They're just slowly walking forward for a long time. So it's just, this is where I really feel like the pace starts to struggle. And I really do feel like it would struggle a lot less if they just didn't include the stock footage. Just then it would flow nicely.
There's also a lot of new stuff in that fight too. Like, it's not like the fight was way too short and they're like, oh man, we gotta pad this out. I feel like they shot a lot of good new stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
That's basically what I was going to say is the stock footage is such a problem and it's so annoying and it's the worst part of this movie. And it's doubly frustrating because, in my opinion, at least so much of the new footage is really good. Like Andrew's comment about, you know, there being no people around, notwithstanding, like there's some beautiful new shots of like first of all, Gigan as a kaiju was just rad. Like just everything about Gigan is freaking rad. And then like the way they light that suit with like the fire effects, and like there must be lights in the building because like the lighting of those new shots with Gigan is so good. And there's some beautiful wide shots of like him and Ghidorah in the same frame, like down at the docks and stuff. Like the new kaiju stuff is really good. There's a really, really good shot of like Anguirus coming ashore, and you've got like the military in like the foreground. Really great like compositing. So it's so frustrating that they felt the need to like have all that stock footage. Much as I love Ghidorah, you could have just not had Ghidorah in this movie and not had Anguirus and just had the same amount of new footage of Godzilla and Gigan, and that would have been fine. It might have been a better movie.
And to be honest, Anguirus and King Ghidorah both look like they could have used the rest anyway.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. They're looking rough.
Poor rotten Anguirus. I mean, I do love the shot you're talking about where he comes out on shore and everything with the military, but he looks like he's moldy. He's got all these green splotches. He is zombie Anguirus. He is literally rotting away as he walks.
His eyes look dead and everything. But yeah, I feel so bad for him in that scene because he just shows up. He's not even attacking. He's just checking out what's going on. And then the military just starts pelting him. And he's like, ow, guys, and he just walks away.
Yeah, Anguirus was not using his Old Spice body wash and skincare routine. But it's kind of funny because in Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, Anguirus is moving around as fast as you would expect him to, and even though he takes a lot of punishment. I do wish he did more in this film in particular. But with that being said, I guess I don't really mind Anguirus and King Ghidorah being kind of the, you know, tag team partners that give the main stars a rest. But I really enjoy the fights in this film. It's just, it feels like whenever you're a kid playing for Godzilla figures, and this is what you expect, you know, even remembering scenes from past movies, you're like, oh yeah, throw this in there. Why not? And yeah, I mean, I really appreciate how, despite the budget, the fight goes from the city to the harbor to like the industrial district for a little bit. And then you're in the countryside and moving into the Godzilla Funland. But man, I adore what this film does of Godzilla himself. Sure, he talks, but yeah, it's on par with the time. It's endearing.
It's funny what you bring up as a positive, I've kind of wrote down as a negative, because yeah, thanks to trying to match up the stock footage, I find the geography of the battle so confusing. Like they're in the city, then they're fighting Mazers in the countryside. Then they're in a refinery that's like adjacent to countryside. Then they're at Children's World, but it occasionally becomes a rocky canyon with a bridge when they're doing Ghidorah three-headed monster footage that doesn't look anything like the terrain of Children's Land. And Children's Land is apparently right next to the ocean at the end. So I don't know, maybe the rocky canyon with the bridge is on the opposite side of Children's Land, but it's just like so disorienting to me. Like, well, where are we now? How did we get there?
Yeah, that's definitely fair. I can see it too. You know, I guess you could say it kind of breaks the action rule of trying to like let the audience know where the surrounding is, you know, and letting them kind of have like something to kind of just ground themselves in. And yeah, the stock footage definitely messes up with that. Like you said, the Ghidorah scene of the bridge after Godzilla gets hit in the balls. But what I really like that when it comes to Godzilla himself, not only is it Nakajima's last performance, but I feel like he really does give it his all. He's having a good time. And the fact that he gets to be with Anguirus one last time, since Nakajima helped pioneer the whole idea of kaiju fights, with Godzilla's first foe being Anguirus, I think it's a little poetic and a nice coincidence that his last Godzilla appearance happened to have Anguirus there. And of course, he gets to toss around King Ghidorah one last time. And Gigan, of course, is... what can I say about Gigan? He's wonderful. He's a Swiss Army knife taped to a dinosaur. And he's from space. Always make your enemy from space. But I just love that scene in the end. Maybe I'm jumping a little too far ahead, but where Godzilla, he gets thrown into the Godzilla Tower after it looks like the aliens are actually going to kill him. And Godzilla gets back up on his feet. And I think Machiko exclaims, "Godzilla's strong again." Then you hear that theme just burst into the scene. Just like no composer for this film, it's just Ifukube stock music. But I love when that theme is blurring. Godzilla gets up and he starts fighting King Ghidorah and Gigan. He doesn't need a power up, he just gets up. He has his Rocky Balboa moment. It's like hearing Rocky's Flying Higher Now theme playing. And I just like it. Godzilla gets back up, he's able to take down Gigan and King Ghidorah, and Anguirus finally gets to do something in those final moments.
I agree, and well, first of all, I want to say I'm really glad you pointed out the thing about Hiro Nakajima's last time as Godzilla being with Anguirus. I like that a lot. I never really like thought about that, but I think that's a really nice way to look at it. But yeah, that's my favorite part in the fight, when Godzilla gets up and he decides he's had enough of this shit and just starts wailing on Gigan. It's so good. And my favorite finisher on Ghidorah in the Showa era is in Invasion of Astro Monster, when Rodan picks up Godzilla and the two fly at him together and knock him into the water. That's amazing. But my second favorite is Godzilla grabbing Ghidorah by the necks in this and just slamming him on the ground a bunch of times. That is so good.
And one little detail I like is that in that final fight we're talking about, the Nibelians are already defeated, and King Ghidorah and Gigan still want to keep fighting because they're, you know, douchebags. But I like that they start turning on each other, and that's why they lose. Because Gigan's like, oh, come on, man. And Ghidorah hits him back, and they start just really getting into it.
Yeah.
And during that, Godzilla and Anguirus able to sneak around and, you know, pull some tricks on them. It's little things like that that I like when it comes to kaiju. Because if they've been around this long, they're going to be intelligent. But what I was saying was Nakajima's last performance, and yeah, there really is no new composer for this film, except that Godzilla finally gets his own theme song, kind of like Gamera and Ultraman. He gets two of them.
Yes, yeah. I love that song.
Wasn't it done by the guy who did the Ultraman score?
Yeah, he did the original theme. And I like how there's the Godzilla March song, and then there's the Go-Go Godzilla theme. And, like, I even found a recent rap song from a couple of years ago that remixed one of those songs into it. Yo, I live life according to the low end theory. A champion, a trophy goes to me clearly. But, yeah, I love that Nakajima got to go out with the sunset blazing, Last Crusade style with his own Godzilla theme song.
And I do really enjoy in that song, they call him, you know, the Monster of Justice, which is also picked up by Zone Fighter. And I think maybe Megalon too. And I like that it is an attempt to give him a new title, just like, you know, Superman is the Man of Steel, the last son of Krypton. But in the 90s, they also would be going with sometimes the Man of Tomorrow. And it's sort of like his less well-known secondary sort of franchise title. And I like that Godzilla got one of that. That's sort of his 70s era specific title. So I think that's really fun.
I agree. And yeah, what you're saying about Nakajima giving a great performance here, I really love the moment when he sees the Godzilla Tower for the first time and he just smacks himself on the head to make sure he's not like hallucinating or something. And I think that's great because it's such a great way to show what your character is feeling without having them say dialogue, you know, despite this technically being a movie where Godzilla does say dialogue. But, you know, it's such a great moment.
That whole sequence is, I think, one of my favorites, just where Ghidorah is using his wings, which is funny because, again, in Zone Fighter next year, that's the aspect of him that they emphasize, his hurricane wing power. So that's like, again, a thing they were just trying to go for specifically in this era. And it's creating this disorienting windstorm. Godzilla can't really see. And then Gigan's coming at him with the buzzsaw out of nowhere. It bleeds him. He tumbles down a hill. And then he like stumbles out of this storm to see this tower doppelganger of himself. It's like this surreal moment where he's being disoriented. He's hit, he's knocked down and thrown for a loop, and then he stumbles out of all of it and is seeing this nonsensical thing that, you know, he just can't make any sense of. It's just a wonderful sort of, it is straight out of a superhero movie. Like if you're fighting Loki or something, you know, or Mysterio, and you're just getting hit from all sides. And then you're stumbling out of this illusory nightmare world and just being like, what am I even seeing here? What's going? He's completely deprived you of all of your bearings and hitting you while you're down. So I love the way that whole scene is pulled off.
Well said. And to kind of build off the Godzilla Tower, it's kind of funny how it's a bit of a precursor to Mechagodzilla himself, you know, coincidentally, and does a lot of damage to Godzilla. And I do wonder if Godzilla himself was kind of taken aback because he saw somebody like another Godzilla that was, you know, his height and his age that wasn't Manila. And I'm sure added to the confusion of the fight.
I'm a little disappointed that it's the humans who take out Godzilla Tower. I kind of wanted to see Godzilla just like lay the smackdown on it. And he kind of does, maybe if I'm remembering correctly, but it's only after the humans have kind of neutralized it as a threat. I just think it would have been cool to see Godzilla take down his doppelganger.
When it comes to the infamous Gigan making Godzilla bleed and like really bleed, it's so prominent in this film. And I think it really sells how much danger Godzilla's in. Because when you think of Godzilla, you think of somebody that's indestructible, right? And it's kind of like whenever you see Superman actually bleed in a big fight with a very powerful foe, you're like, oh no, right? Like, that's not supposed to happen. And I know Godzilla bled for a little bit in Hedorah when he gets hit like in the head for a shot. You can see kind of blood trickling down. But the fact that Gigan's able to make him bleed so much, I think it just is a different kind of danger that I like. And I feel like nowadays, whenever Godzilla bleeds, it's not much of like a oh shit moment, so to speak, if that makes sense. Because he bleeds quite a bit in the Monsterverse, whether it's the Muto fight, even if it's a little hard to see, or the fight with Mechagodzilla. And even in that recent Monarch show, he bleeds in the final fight in that show for a quick shot. But I really like in this film how Godzilla bleeding just makes it feel so much more tense.
I really like the when Gigan and Ghidorah arrive at Earth. I really love the like crystal effect.
Yeah.
How they're like in these crystals and then they like explode. Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster did this too. With Ghidorah like traveling in that meteorite. I just love the idea of like the way space monsters get around is they just like convert themselves to energy and like are stored in like these containers that travel through space. I just think that's such a cool idea.
And honestly, that whole reveal scene from the beginning where it pulls back from the tower, then Japan, then the Earth points into space. Then they get released. Then they sort of do that Zod, I'm free moment where they do the loop-de-loop. Like, that whole thing is so good.
Yeah, it's very cool. The only bad part about that reveal is when they get to the Earth and they fly around Godzilla Tower. And Godzilla Tower looks like it's like 1,000 feet tall. And then later you see that it's not that much taller than Godzilla.
Right. I don't count that. The reveal is good. And that's a separate sucky scene.
Yeah.
Don't count that one.
Yeah, fair enough.
But also, sadly, the flying Ghidorah prop is disappointingly stiff, which is noticeable because Ghidorah is a monster that's always kind of, you know, his heads are always flailing around and stuff.
But at least it's new footage. At least his when he explodes out of the crystal, they didn't reuse the Ghidorah, the three-headed monster flame thing that they did in Destroy All Monsters. At least it's all new.
It's a good point.
This Ghidorah creeps my wife out. Because, again, just like Anguirus, he kind of looks like, I mean, not the flying prop per se, but he just kind of looks like he's zombified, like he is rotting away. And this isn't even, this is the last time we see him in the movies in the Showa series, although he will appear again next year in Zone Fighter. But he's definitely feeling that beating he took in Destroy All Monsters. He's not doing so well. And, of course, the books very stupidly suggest that this is a second King Ghidorah because they think he's beaten too easily here in Zone Fighter, which, as we put a defense in our Zone Fighter episodes, members of the audience should go back and listen there. We did put our defense why, no, he makes just as good a showing here as he did in any of the other movies, but because it's the fan perception that he was a pushover, they say, oh, this is a second, different, weaker King Ghidorah, different than the one in the other three movies. And I think that's just stupid.
Yeah, totally. For me, there's only one King Ghidorah, one Showa King Ghidorah. You know, and it helps that Destroy All Monsters had that little time skip too in the future. But I gotta wonder if King Ghidorah gets a concussion in one head, does he feel it in all the heads?
We need to ask a kaiju kinesiologist.
Did any of you guys watch Chibi Godzilla raids again?
No,
I have not, sadly.
I highly, highly recommend it. It's only 10 episodes, and they have great gimmicks for, you know, Rodan is completely lacking in self-confidence and crashes to the ground anytime, yelling, Rodan! Anytime he's criticized. Mothra is really shy, and everything that Shobijin say on her behalf, they are very clearly making up themselves and is not what her intent is. But they always just add, she says at the end to make it sound like that was from Mothra. And Chibi Ghidorah's thing is that his heads are just constantly fighting over food because they all share one stomach. So they can't eat three times the food. It fills them up, but only one of them gets to taste it. And so they're constantly fighting over which of them gets to be the one that does the actual eating because the other two will get left out. That was just what this conversation was making me think of. They have some really great gags in that series.
That's really great.
That's amazing, Andrew. I'm going to check that out.
Highly recommended to our audience as well. I think since it's Raids again, there must be an original Chibi Godzilla series too. I haven't watched that one yet. But yeah, the new one is just really, really funny. Chibi Mechagodzilla is the irritated straight man, and Chibi Godzilla is just a complete idiot. So he's constantly, what are you even talking about? What? None of this makes any sense.
I saw the clip of Godzilla in karaoke singing his theme, that da 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 da, you know, and Mechagodzilla was like, it doesn't even have words.
Yes, exactly. Just like in Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, this points out that Godzilla never uses his atomic breath against him in this movie. So in only 50% of their battles does he actually use the atomic ray against Ghidorah, which is kind of weird for someone who's supposed to be one of his most powerful opponents. You'd think you'd pull out the heavy hitter for that.
Well, maybe Godzilla had some sympathy for him. Like, he knew his atomic breath could really hurt him because, you know, Ghidorah goes out to Manila's atomic ring.
We haven't talked so much about Godzilla and Anguirus outside of the fight.
Yeah. So there's like two scenes of them talking, right? There's one where they're just on Monster Island and then one where they're in the ocean.
Yes.
In the Japanese cut, it's speech bubbles. In the US cut, it's like actual words.
Yeah.
Something funny going on. You better check.
Which, incidentally, that was Ted Thomas, who was, you know, head of the Americanization team, giving his performance as Godzilla and Anguirus. I really love the word bubbles because it's just so, you know, the whole theme of this movie is like manga and comic book art.
Yeah.
So it's wonderfully thematic for that.
That's a good point. I like that a lot, too. Yeah, I mean, I don't really have much to say about it. Godzilla and Anguirus talk to each other with words in this movie.
Which is controversial, but I mean, it's not like previous films haven't already established that they can communicate on an intelligent level. Like, we already got that in Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster.
True.
And yeah, maybe hearing it out loud is a step too far, but that wasn't Toho's intention. That was just something that the dubber put in, so.
I mean, every 70s movie has a funny gimmick, right? Like, Ghidorah, he flies. Here he talks. Megalon has the tail slide. And then Mechagodzilla has the magnet powers.
And Terror of Mechagodzilla is like, yeah, I'm too serious for that nonsense.
Yeah. That...
yeah. But he does rise up out of, like, literally nowhere. So, I mean, you could still count that.
Yeah, he teleports in. He gets the power of teleportation for one scene.
Right, pretty much. Geographically nonsensical entry, which, to be fair, he also appears from behind the horizon in Ghidorah in the dream sequence. And what was the other one I was thinking of? Oh, and out of a warehouse out of nowhere in Mechagodzilla. So in the 70s, he also has a crazy entrance every time.
Yeah. The thing about that scene that's bizarre to me is not so much the fact that they're talking. It's the fact that Godzilla is, like, giving Anguirus orders.
Yeah, it is a little weird.
Like, they're not so much allies as much as, like, Anguirus is, like, his dog or something. Like,
he's his protege.
Yeah, yeah, it's like his Robin.
It is weird, but one thing I love the talking scene for giving us Anguirus saying, okay, both with the speech bubble, just has okay written with an exclamation point, and in the dub he says it. And there's like, you know, you can buy Anguirus t-shirts that have the okay speech bubble. I was watching the Godzilla Fest stream from Japan, you know, back in November on Godzilla Day. And it was like, there were no subtitles, so I couldn't really tell what the guy was saying. But at one point I hear him say Anguirus' name. And then like a couple seconds later, I hear him say, okay, out loud. And I'm like, instantly know what he's getting at. And I'm like, you know, it's just like this weird little thing that forever became a part of Anguirus' legacy. And I don't know why, but like, I'm so glad that that's a thing.
Me too, man. You know, I hope in the new Empire, there's a scene of Godzilla and Kong right as they're, you know, running, bark before they start running. And Kong's like, Godzilla, there's something funny going on. And Godzilla's like, whatever.
There is an edit of the shot of them running next to each other where they put the speech bubbles.
Is there? Because the only one I saw was about the subway $5 foot long. And Kong says satisfactory, and it's like the funniest thing.
That is really good. All right, we should probably get back on track.
So, speaking of Godzilla and Gigan, I really do like the bit at the end where they just kind of huddle to discuss strategy. Like, we don't get any word bubbles for it, but it's just a fun idea. I love seeing them actually, like, unlike Jet Jaguar or King Caesar, where he seems to have this unspoken, like, psychic bond where they just know what he wants them to do. It's fun to just see them, like, actually making a plan together. I think that that's really, really neat. And then while they do a good job of that whole tension and of whether Godzilla will recover, and like you talked about earlier, like the Rocky Balboa moment of him rallying and everything, I do think the full 12 minutes after the tower explodes become a bit anticlimactic. Like, them turning the tables just goes on a little bit too long. Like, I think it was a really good idea. And, you know, when Godzilla rallies, I'm right there for it. But between the point where he rallies and the point where the two run off, there's just a little, it just goes on a little too long, I feel like.
One other thing, because I didn't really say this, but even with the films that I like the least, I still have good things to say, because my least favorite part of this movie actually is all the monster stuff. And even then, I've still been mostly complimenting it here. But one of the things that makes it so like awkward to me, aside from the stock footage, is that there are so many shots during like the rampage with Gigan and Ghidorah where they're off screen, but you can see their beams coming in and blowing up buildings. And like, that's okay, like for a few shots, but I feel like there's so many parts where they're like, where you're just seeing the destruction and the monsters off screen roaring and firing beams. And there's just something about it that's so awkward to me.
And we do get that again in Megalon. We have his horn laser that I don't think he ever uses in the fight with Godzilla. He just uses it so they can use shots of King Ghidorah's gravity beams destroying buildings.
Yep.
Which is just not so great. And I feel like I ought to mention, I did spend a fair amount of time working on a fan edit for this. With the help of my wife as a cartoonist and illustrator, we actually redid the word bubbles. I recreated them, you know, hand recreated them frame by frame, tracing the bubble shapes. And we actually had English on-screen text, because the translation of the words on Anguirus's "What do you want?" The literal Japanese words are like, "What unreasonable request."
Oh, that's so good.
So "what do you want" is a good way of putting it. Like, you know, it's just sort of the idea of, you shouldn't be asking me this, you know, what do you want now? But we chose to render that as "what the bleep do you want?" And just actually used like the cartoon, you know, a little bomb with the fuse lit and a skull and crossbones and a lightning bolt. Cartoon swearing things, because we thought that would fit the comics theme. And I also had my brother, who's a sound designer, create an original sound effects, and we added Gigan's forehead beam back into that one shot where he has the flash on his forehead where there was supposed to be a beam there. And I tried to put the opening credits in English, but unfortunately I only had an SD source, so just like my fan edit of King Kong versus Godzilla, I made it just a few years before the high-definition prints came out, and I would need to completely redo it now to make it look Blu-ray quality. But the main reason that I never finished and released it, although I do have copies. If anyone's interested in seeing it, let me know. I was also trying to actually fix the day for night and recolor grade it to have the sky actually black and to have it actually match the other footage. And no, no way. The footage, the colors are not vibrant enough to do a color key like blue screening. The rotoscoping is a nightmare. It just looked awful. It didn't work, and it was a terrible idea. And now that I know that there were 7 solid minutes of stock footage, no wonder I spent months and months and months on that, and it still felt like I was never getting anywhere. But yeah, that was my Gigan fan edit that does still exist. I have clips of the English word bubbles and the Gigan forehead beam, and I also went and took a cue from the Godzilla Resurrection fan edit for Return of Godzilla in 1985 and added the sounds of like Anguirus and Ghidorah fighting in the distance whenever just Godzilla and, you know, Gigan are shown and vice versa. So it feels like they're still there, because if you're watching, they do just drop out for minutes at a time. And you're like, what are those other two guys even doing? I can't see them. I can't hear them. It's like they ceased existing until Godzilla and Gigan come to tag them in. So I did all that. It was a lot of work. It took many, many months. Then I had kids and my day for night regrading failed. And between the 1-2 punch of just not having time anymore and a major aspect of it falling through, I gave up on ever getting it finished and out there. But the version of the stuff that I did finish could be cut into the movie pretty easily if anyone ever wants to see it.
Yeah, sounds really great. And
yeah, it sounds awesome.
I appreciate you at least trying to fix the day for night.
You are the hero this fandom needs.
I will claim that title, but only because I translated Zone Fighter.
Yeah, to our viewers listening, Andrew's the man. His work is great. If you have not checked it out, I will find you.
Oh, you are very sweet.
True. Andrew is the man.
Andrew was just wanted to watch it for himself. That's all it really is. You know, it was selfishness that just happened to benefit everybody else.
So let's move on to the score for this film, which was, in a way, sort of composed by Akira Ifukube. As Ike said earlier, the film uses stock music from films that were previously scored by Akira Ifukube, but also featuring an original song by Kunio Miyauchi, once again, as Ike said earlier.
I really like the piece of music that they used for the opening credits.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I don't know what that's from. Is that new? I know it's not from, aside from the part where they play the Godzilla theme, I don't think it's from another Godzilla movie.
I think it's from Birth of Japan.
Oh, is it?
I might be wrong, but...
Yeah, Toho Kingdom doesn't say, it just says largely stock genre themes from Ifukube, although a few outside sources such as Will to Conquer from 1970 did slip in. But unfortunately, they do not break down specifically which ones. But they used some from Frankenstein versus Baragon. It's just a hodgepodge of almost everything. Oh, wait. It says main title. It has from The Big Boss, Mothra versus Godzilla, and Battle in Outer Space.
Oh.
And then looking through the rest of this, again, this is from Toho Kingdom. We also have Will to Conquer, Destroy All Monsters, Atragon, Frankenstein versus Baragon, some of these being repeated, Latitude Zero, I'm skipping ones that I've already said, Ghidorah of the Three-Headed Monsters, King Kong Escapes, and then, of course, the ending originally composed Godzilla March. So yeah, all of those films served as donors, but the Big Boss theme, it looks like the one that Akira Ifukube originally composed and that was used as that opening credit.
That's awesome. I'll have to check that out. The Big Boss.
But yeah, so that is a lot of donors for one movie.
Right.
And I think that's why it ends up kind of forgettable, because while they're using pieces from all over, none of them were especially ever designed to go together. And so there's probably nothing coherent or thematic ever really comes from it.
Yeah, no, this movie's soundtrack is basically like a greatest hits album. None of it has any connection, but it's fun because it's a Ifukube, so it's all good. It's all good music. There was music, I can't remember what it was exactly, but I got the time code. It's the music that played at 22:40, so 22 minutes, 40 seconds. I was like, oh, yep, that's cool music. So I wrote that down.
Go put your Criterion Blu-ray in there and go figure out which track James is talking about. Also, hi, I switched rooms, so I'm echoey now.
Yeah, yeah, write in and tell me what I liked, because I already don't remember. There was a funny musical moment where we cut from the monster fighting to, I think it's the human characters are like approaching the tower. They're about to like, you know, do stuff to the tower. And the score just gets like quiet and like far away. And it's almost like the score is like actually diegetic. It's like it's happening over off in the distance where the monsters are fighting. I just thought that was a really funny choice.
Maybe the Nebulans have like a really good sound system and they're just blaring all the music you're hearing.
Yeah, they're like Blast of Destruction mixtape.
In the 70s, we actually get a fair number of songs, actually. You know, 60s are the heyday of songs because of Mothra and, you know, various native chants to various things. But in the 70s, we get Save the Earth, and then we get some Cetopian chanting and the Jet Jaguar song. We got this Godzilla March, and then we get the King Caesar song. And, you know, this is a really good battle. I was going to say this is probably, like, my favorite. And then I was like, oh, no, but Jet Jaguar is actually really good. And I was like, oh, man, and the King Caesar one's actually really good. Like, these are all bops. These are all, like, 70s Godzilla songs actually make a jamming playlist. Like, we got some good stuff in this era.
It's true. They are all kind of good.
And if you throw the Zone Fighter songs in there, even better. I just kind of want a mixtape of all these songs now. And like I said, throw the Zone Fighter ones on there, and this would, that'd be a good time, man. That'd be a great road trip right there.
What if I told you I made a playlist on YouTube of all the Godzilla tie-in songs?
Did you really?
Including Zone Fighter. I'll have to link it.
Yeah, you gotta send me to that. And let's put that in the show notes for our listeners.
Heck yeah.
Because that would be awesome.
Yeah, I pulled them off of different YouTube videos, you know. But there's also a Defeat Gigan song for this film, I believe. Just like there's a Defeat Megalong song and Defeat Mechagodzilla theme. It's like a little song that kind of like get kids hyped up for the fight, I think. It's a very like tie-in of a tie-in song. But I think my favorite of all time would have to be The Words Get Stuck in My Throat from War of the Gargantuans.
Oh gosh.
I'm kidding.
So who's your MVP for Godzilla versus Gigan?
Mine is, I think, Hiro Nakajima. Ike put it really well. He gives a really great performance, very animated, lots of characterization. It was a good one for him to go out on because he did a great job. Some real primo suit acting from the best who ever did it.
My MVP of Godzilla versus Gigan is Yuriko Hashimi, who played Tomoko. She played Anne in Ultra 7, and that just stands out to me. But I also want to shout out that thank you, Toho, for taking the fans' money and making the Godzilla vs. Gigan tokusatsu short film.
It's breadcrumbs.
Yeah, hell yeah. But thanks for making me be able to see the Showa Gigan once again in my lifetime.
That is my favorite of those shorts, and it is also my favorite Gigan suit. It looks so good, and I love watching that thing. Put it back on YouTube, Toho. Let us enjoy the hard work of your filmmakers. My MVP is Hiroshi Ishikawa, who played Gengo, because he's, like I said, I think he's a really funny actor, does a lot of really funny things in this movie. Don't have much to say about him other than that. I just think he's entertaining, and I appreciate his performance a lot.
None of you took either of mine, so I think I'm just going to have to double dip here. Joining along, two of you have already called out human cast members, so I would add to that Minoru Takashima, whose delightful portrayal of the corncob hippie is an iconic favorite. But also, Takeyoshi Mizuki, the Shonen Magazine illustrator, who designed Gigan. And I mean, what a gift to the ongoing franchise that, as you talk about with that short, you know, we are still reaping the benefits 50 years later of his hard work.
I think that just about covers it. So let's just move on to our final thoughts.
I guess for my final thought is that I'm sure every Godzilla fan has tried writing their own Godzilla script or some kind of treatment. And I just want to say somehow Gigan has ended up being the main antagonist of this script I'm thinking about and I've been writing. So props to Gigan for always being in my heart.
And you've got some great ideas for that thing, by the way.
Well, I could kiss you, Nick.
I will be honest here. Within the past few years, this has sadly fallen to the bottom five of my, you know, Godzilla rankings. We'll see how that ends up now because I'm in the middle of a marathon with a friend of mine. But just compared to all the other Godzilla movies, well, not all of them, but a lot of the other most of the other Godzilla movies, I just find this one a little harder to sit through. The first half of it, you know, it's pretty engaging for me. And then the monster stuff, for the most part, really bores me. But that said, most of what I said here is still, you know, pretty much good things, which I think is probably just a testament to how obsessed I am with Godzilla. So, but yeah, you know, even the Godzilla movies I like the least, I still can't truly say that I actively dislike them because they've all got things I enjoy no matter what. Like I said in the Godzilla vs. Megaguirus episode, if it has Godzilla in it, it can't be the worst thing I've ever seen.
Amen.
I like this movie. I think it's fun. I think it's not the strongest, but I think for the 70s Godzilla films, they have a real charm that's all to their own. And you just have to kind of take them on their own terms. I love Gigan. I think he's just absolutely charming and one of my favorite kaiju ever. And I think when this movie is doing new stuff with its kaiju footage, it's all really well done. It's just a shame that there had to be so much stock footage because a lot of what's in this movie is quite beautiful to look at. So it's not the strongest Godzilla movie. It'll always sit lower for me, but there is some true value to it.
Something I forgot to say earlier that I might as well say now is that, you know, not only did this movie give us Gigan, who's amazing, but it's sort of also, I think this is the movie that made Anguirus the fan favorite he is. Because, you know, he fought Godzilla and Raids Again, which is a movie that sadly most people don't really like, but I think most of us like it. And then he's in Destroy All Monsters, where he does some cool things, but he has a more minimal role, I'd say. And this is the one, you know, I always hear people saying that Anguirus is Godzilla's best friend, even over Rodan, who's, you know, appeared alongside Godzilla as his ally numerous times. And I think it's because something about Anguirus's role in this movie, for whatever reason, left an impression on Godzilla fans. And I think this movie is the reason why so many people love Anguirus. And I love Anguirus. He's just great. I didn't mean to finish my final thoughts going off about Anguirus, but like I said, I forgot to say that earlier, so here it is.
And we do end up getting him then in the next two movies in more cameo roles, but he's a constant for almost the whole rest of the series. So I find Godzilla vs. Gigan is an odd duck, much like Gigan himself, although that's really more of a cybernetic chicken. There's a heavy reliance on stock footage to pad out a lengthy battle sequence, what feels like the longest in the franchise until Space Godzilla comes along, as I mentioned before. The drab color palette and relative sparsity of sets, cast, and even plot does kind of lend the proceedings a lifelessness, especially compared to its direct predecessor and successor. I think it is probably the most serious of the 70s films, lacking some of the comic book zaniness of its surrounding entries. Even the more somber seriousness of Terror of Mechagodzilla still feels like you've got the insanity of Mughal and, you know, cyborg surgeries and Titanosaurus with his wind powers. There's less mundaneness than it feels like is contained in this film. Even though it's entirely about comic books, it's lacking a lot of those comic book qualities that Megalon and Hedorah and All Monsters Attack and versus Mechagodzilla all have. However, even though it might seem like the most kind of bland and lifeless of the entries on its face, it's also got some of the most fun characters in the 70s era whose relationships really shine on screen. And I would call that probably the most memorable all-around cast of the decade, as I mentioned. And the wonderful comic-inspired kaiju communication that's so thematically and wonderfully unique. And in spite of the stock footage padding, as you guys have mentioned, the original fight sequences are really excellent. And Gigan's, you know, shocking, bloodying attack on Godzilla as he stumbles around blindly in the mist is very deserving of its reprise in Megalon because it's a great sequence. The pacing gets a bit stuck in several spots of heavy kaiju action when the humans have nothing to do and stock footage is heavily involved. The film might have benefited from just using its original footage. As I said, I think that would have kept the sequences lean and well-paced. But regardless of, you know, repeating myself on so many of these points, even though I think the execution's a mixed bag, the lower production values and occasional slow spots are just well worth sitting through for the engaging character scenes and the really unique concepts that make the film so special. The total package might be a bit of a mixed bag with peaks and valleys, highlights and slow spots, but I feel like the tapestry of the franchise would be much duller without this film's contributions, and the negative points are well worth putting up with to see all of the positive points, especially just such a great cast of characters.
So before we get to our listener feedback, I just want to point you all in the direction of Ike's latest YouTube video, Mechagodzilla's Legacy, The Ultimate Godzilla Foe. This year is, of course, Mechagodzilla's 50th anniversary, and while we don't have any plans for that, Ike on his YouTube channel released a really, really great video about the character, and I really highly recommend it, especially if you love Mechagodzilla as much as Ike and I do. There's a link for that in the description of this episode, so that way if you want to watch it, all you gotta do is go down there and click that link, and then boom, you're watching it. But of course, as always, we've got some listener feedback, the first of which is an Apple Podcasts review by Liam Vesley. Excuse me if I pronounced that wrong. The title of the review is Great Podcast for All Kaiju Fans, and the review reads, "This podcast is great for any kaiju fan. The hosts provide a great mix of opinions that make for an entertaining listen," with a little smiley face. So thank you, Liam. It really warms our heart to read that review. And on top of that review, we have feedback from Jonathan Steimer in response to both episode 62 and bonus episode 5, which were both about Godzilla 2000. Jonathan writes, "Wanted to write in and comment on both Godzilla 2000 episodes since somehow I missed the initial one when it was posted. I find it fascinating that everyone on this podcast universally loves it because, well, I do not. It's not that there's nothing good here, but it's not easy for me to hand wave away the very obvious issues with the special effects and writing when I don't have any real nostalgia for this movie. I'll try to keep it brief and probably fail because there are three different big issues. The first is the effects. I'm curious to watch the Japanese version because the CGI in the American version and some of the shots of Godzilla moving over land or onto land are rough. There's the obvious swimming scene, but also any scene with the spaceship is really ugly. The scene near the beginning where the windshield shatters is pretty painful, and the scene where Godzilla makes landfall just before the tanks fire at him is possibly the worst version of that scene I've ever seen as far as effects go. These are huge issues that really take me out of the movie right near the start. Second issue is the characters. You all mentioned loving Katagiri, and he's got potential, but he feels so wasted in the end. He feels like someone who could have been the central focus, and he doesn't really get a time to shine. I wanted more of him. Yuki and Io have always gotten on my nerves. Their banter just isn't fun. Shinoda certainly exists in this movie. Also, the dubbed dialogue and voice acting stinks, in my opinion. Before I get to the third issue, I do want to give credit where I can. The new Godzilla suit looks pretty good, though something about the face seems just a little off. The fight between Orga and Godzilla is good, but I did want more of that too, and preferably with the practical suit and not the terrible CGI portion. The kill shot is nice, but the best kill shot ever remains the Muto beheading in Godzilla 2014. The final issue is the ending. The battle is over too fast, and then Godzilla makes a beeline for the human characters for seemingly no reason, kills Katagiri while the others don't run, and then walks away? It doesn't make much sense in any regard. Why didn't Katagiri run or at least take a single step backwards? Why does Godzilla stop attacking once Katagiri is dead? Why does Katagiri yell Godzilla's name, then Shinoda does the same thing for Katagiri while ignoring both Godzilla and his daughter? Why does Godzilla walk away, then only once he's away from our protagonist, decide to set the city around him on fire? I will note, I've not seen the Japanese cut, but I did buy the Blu-ray just to get a chance to do so. Elfie's enthusiasm for that cut was enough for me to give it a try. I'll make a much shorter comment once I get a chance to watch that. I do love your commentary, and often I agree with you, but this is one I felt the need to write in with an alternative opinion. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts on Godzilla Minus One, as that one is absolutely phenomenal. Can't wait to see the Minus Color version tomorrow. Thank you, Jonathan, and I really hope you enjoyed our Minus One episode. We had a great time recording it, and yeah, that movie is just unbelievable. Sadly, I missed the Minus Color version because I happened to get COVID the one and only week that it was in theaters. But yeah, I mean, I appreciate this comment because I don't often hear negative opinions on Godzilla 2000. So it is interesting to hear from someone who doesn't think so highly of it. That said, I definitely, definitely recommend the Japanese cut if you don't like the US cut, especially since a big problem for you is the effects and you're also not into the dubbing. And, you know, if you don't like those things watching the US cut, then obviously the dubbing won't be a problem in the Japanese cut. And like Elfie says plenty of times, the effects, like the wonky parts of the effects in this movie look way, way better in the Japanese cut. I think the brightness they give to the US cut really hurts those effects. So I can understand where you're coming from there. And again, just, thank you for sending that in. We appreciate hearing from all of you, even whenever you heavily disagree with us. And of course, if you want to get into contact with us, you can do so through Twitter and Instagram at GForce Kaiju Pod, Facebook at facebook.com/GForceKaijuPod, or just type GForce a Kaiju Podcast into the search bar. You can email us at GForceKaijuPod@gmail.com. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts. You can rate us on Spotify, and you can leave a comment under this episode on Spotify or any others if you feel so inclined. And again, check out that video by Ike. It's really good. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time for the next four issues of Godzilla Rulers of Earth. In the meantime, we'll be signing off by telling you about some of Gango's monsters that were rejected for not being relatable enough for the kids.
I've been Ike, and if you're not watching Godzilla, Tokusatsu, and Kaiju, what are you doing? Because Guinness Gan, the kaiju who attacks Guinness beer factories, will come after you if you don't watch it.
I've been James. And everyone run in terror from Sincerely Ra, the passive-aggressive work email monster.
This has been Andrew, and sooner or later, you will have to grapple with Nemoira, the monster of waning energy, especially after you have kids.
So I've been Nick, and if you're feeling a little too lazy to make dinner tonight, you better reconsider, because if you go out there, you might get menaced by King Burgera, the fast food monster.
We need to crowdfund a short for King Burgera to fight that McDonald's mecca from the Godzilla McDonald's commercials.
I'll buy that for a dollar.
We're doing history with the movie?
Yep.
Is the thing? Okay. Should I go?
Yeah, man, if you want.
Okay.
Go for it.
Okay.
James, you said you thought that Ike said it pretty well?
Yeah.
Okay. My audio is low, you know, definition right now. So I thought you were saying, I thought I put it pretty well. I was like, wow, that's pretty surprisingly arrogant for James. I was patting himself on the back like that.
Well, I take the position that whatever anyone says in an episode of the podcast that I'm in is really my idea. I take control. I take ownership. And, yeah, everything you've said now belongs to me.
Wow. Well, I can't fight you. You'll just take me to court and win. You'll play everybody in court. I'm just going to be stuck being myself in a piece of paper.
Been his master plan all along.
So you're all welcome for me translating Zone Fighter. It was a lot of work.
Yeah, but your day for night stuff on Gigan sucks.
Ah, you got me. You got me.
Okay, real talk, though. I'm looking at it now. It actually looks pretty good, all things considered.
Those were the highlights. There's a lot more that I'm not showing you that didn't look as good. I'm also just going to suggest other conceptual monsters that Gango might have invented for his comic books along the lines of, you know, the homework monster and the too strict monster and the like.
I like that. My idea was just to quote lyrics from that song simply because I wanted to somehow work in with his enormous body and droopy eyes. Because that line's
that is